Welcome to the Emerge Leadership Connection, the podcast that gives you the keys to unlock your heroic potential, develop into a legendary leader, and emerge into who you were meant to be. On today's episode, we have a conversation with Steven Sauchin, founder of Zero Shoes, and discuss, is Napoleon Hill full of nonsense? Is there any sense in the world of personal development? And a favorite quote of mine from this episode, you can't be smart when you're stupid. What does that mean? Find out here. I'm your host, Cody Dakota, founder of the Leadership Guide and finalist for the Extraordinarian Award for Coaches with Ideas that can change people, businesses, and the world for the better for my ideas on leadership. Stay tuned to the end of the episode to discover how to join the League of Legendary Leaders, an association of leaders with the goal to raise $100,000 monthly to support nonprofit causes which are currently looking to impact the world and make it better for generations to come. Now, on to the show.
As if by magic.
I know, right? All right, we're on. So how are you doing today, Steven?
Like always, good, and I need a nap.
Oh, man, don't we all?
Apparently. I can only speak for myself. I totally do.
All right, awesome. Well, so I met you at the New Media Summit, and one, you were absolutely hilarious.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But two, you brought up some pretty bold claims. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
I'm known for doing that, seems.
Definitely. Yeah, nothing wrong with that at all. There needs to be bold people in the world.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And so I know that part of your claims were that you don't believe a lot in what a lot of the gurus say, quote unquote.
A lot
of it is hocus pocus.
Yeah, that was very kind that you toned it down. I actually said that almost all of it is bullshit. So
yeah.
Yeah. But only because I didn't want to say all of it is, even though that's probably closer to what I think.
All right. Well, what makes you say that? Just curious.
Well, it's really easy. You know, human beings, all of us, we have this, one of the tendencies we have, one of the psychological patterns that we engage in, is that we are continually trying to figure out what we need to do to get something that will make us happy in the imagined future. And one of the things that we do in order to figure out what will get us there is look to the past. And the problem is that we are blinded. Literally, there's a thing called hindsight bias or hindsight blindness, where we will look for example. If we say, I want to have a successful business, then it seems natural to say, well, let's look at other successful businesses and figure out what they have in common. But that's meaningless, because what you might find is that whatever they have in common has nothing to do with why they're successful. It may be, and it is the case, that there will be an infinitely larger number of companies that have those same things in common that ended up not being successful. And so we're going to overlook the things that the failing, quote unquote, failing companies had in common, that with the ones that became successful, we'll overlook the fact that there may be other factors that led to the success of the companies that we're examining. And so we're just completely wrong. So hindsight bias is a problem. Related to that one is a thing called survivorship bias. It's the same basic idea. We look at the winners, we don't look at the losers. And when we're trying to come up with a story or a technique or a method or a whatever for getting the thing that we think that we want. Now, of course, there's a fundamental problem in that too. Ultimately, we think that what we want is to be successful, for example. It seems somewhat self-evident because we think that being successful will make us happier. Seems self-evident. Neither of those things are true. Your happiness is not going to be dependent on whether you're successful or not. And the easy way to find that out is go meet a whole bunch of successful people, and you'll find out that a lot of them are just miserable for various reasons, or certainly no more happy than you, even if they can buy more crap or do more things or you know, date better looking people or whatever it is. So that's the biggest one. I mean, look, as an example, I'll see if I can get in trouble for this. Simon Sinek has become massively popular for telling stories of how, you know, what these companies have that they have in common that made them successful. It's all about their mission, and that's what they lead with. And he uses
start
Apple.
Start with why.
Yeah, start with why. So, and he uses Apple as an example. Mm-hmm. Does anyone not remember Apple in the 90s when they almost went under and we all thought they were a shit company? You know, yeah. I mean, so the fact that they're successful now, who cares? Remember, does anyone remember when Enron was being used as the example for how to be a revolutionary new company before they went under for being lying sacks of crap? So, pardon me, you caught me on a rant day.
Go for it. I love it.
All right, and I hope people don't have a problem with syllables in a particular order because I'm using them all. So that's the biggest thing. This whole idea that there's a single path to become successful or any replicable path to become successful is just born out to be not true by the lack of examples of people who've been able to replicate those paths. So when someone says to me, for example, who do you admire? I don't really have a good answer for that because I don't really care about what other people did. I'm not those people. Richard Branson, you know, I'm not going to be the next Richard Branson. No one's going to be the next Richard Branson. Even Richard Branson isn't Richard Branson. If you met him, you would find that what you think of him is not who he really is. And what he did in business, you know, that's one part of what he did. But look, I'm a competitive sprinter. I'm one of the fastest guys over 55. That's not because there's some replicable path for getting that way. It's because I had the parents that I had and the parents that they had and the parents that they had. And because there's certain things that I'm interested in for reasons that I can't explain. And, you know, so it's the same thing in business. It's amazing. I'll stop in a second. It's, it's amazing that we have no problem thinking that someone like Michael Jordan or Shaq or Steph Curry or whatever is a crazy outlier. And we hold them up as an example of, you know, this is an unusual, amazing, never to be seen before phenomenon. But we don't think the same thing about business or our own career paths or whatever. Like, why is it not equally true that the thing that made them unique and unusual is also true about companies or also true about careers or also true about whatever? And just by the definition of that, it means it's highly unlikely that I'm going to be the next Steph Curry as a 5'5", 56-year-old guy. or that anybody else is for that matter. And the proof again, how many Steph Currys are there right now? As far as I can tell, one. And this is where there's a lot of value in being the next Steph Curry. A lot of people want to be the next Steph Curry. They're not going to be Steph Curry. So anyway, that's part of my thing. Last thing. In fact, one of my favorite books is Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Taleb. And that whole book is basically about what I just said, that we think that there is this replicable path. And the more we think that, and the more we think that we're the ones who are responsible for making that happen, the more likely we are to be screwed. You know, the number one correlate between to someone having a failing company is that they had a successful company before. And it's because when they start their second one, they usually have the same feeling that they had about the first one. Like, I thought that first idea was great, and I was right. So I got that same feeling about the second one. I'm definitely right again. But, you know, the universe has changed, and if they're trying to replicate what they did before, it might not even be applicable now. And I know someone's going to say, but here's this guy who, you know, started five companies, and they were all successful. Great. Find me another. You know, so we love to use the outliers as examples of the proof of what's possible when, by their very definition, they are outliers and not replicable.
Okay, gotcha. So this actually leads me to an interesting question, right? One particular author that comes to my mind top of head that everyone always talks about, right? Because of their research into what it takes to be successful. And I'm sure you know exactly who you're about to hear. Napoleon Hill, right?
Complete bullshit. Now, sorry, did I say that? Did I mention complete bullshit? So look, keep going, but I mean, I know where I'm going to go.
Well, yeah, and the reason I ask is because Napoleon Hill spent 20 years researching what made successful people.
Bullshit.
That's okay. That's fine.
Napoleon Hill wrote that book as an advertising tool to sell his workshops to tell you how to get rich. That's it. People don't realize that. Napoleon Hill was the Tony Robbins of his day. He just didn't have neuro-linguistic programming and, you know, firewalking or whatever. This idea that he spent 20 years, all he did was the exact same shit that I just told you about. He identified, he's making up this story that these 20 people have in common. Most people haven't even read that book, because if they really read that book, they would know that one of the things he said they all have in common is that they withheld their sexual energy. They, like, you know, didn't have sex. They didn't masturbate. They didn't, like, what? First of all, you actually think that the top 20, whatever people and whatever, you know, whoever he interviewed were actually willing to talk to him about their masturbatory habits? I mean, come on. But I mean, but it's the same thing. Again, that's an that's one of the best examples ever of everything that I just talked about. It's a guy who tried to reverse engineer it by only talking to the people who had survived, making up stories of what made them what made them have commonalities. Yes, you're pointing at me.
Yeah. The thing about that is, if, and maybe I'm wrong, because I'm more than open to admit that I'm wrong, but from what I've read, he studied not only 500 of the most successful people, but also 2,000 people who were considered complete failures.
Complete bullshit. And I'll tell you why I say it. Look, if we're going to get metaphysical about it, we're going to have fun. Here's the way we know it's bullshit. All those people that he interviewed, all of them, they all died. So who cares? Eventually, we all die. It ends in the same place for us all. What happens in the meantime? You know, and literally, who cares if they're successful? Who cares? Do you want to have a happy life? If you think being successful is required for being a happy life, having a happy life, I guarantee you're miserable. Guaranteed. And now you might, you know, and there, again, there's going to be outliers and exceptions and some people who think they're really happy because they're full of adrenaline and full of energy and whatever. Just wait, man. I mean, and I'm not saying that they're bad or they're horrible or it's all going to end badly. because that's not the point. It's simply that happy, this idea that we, sorry, here's my other thing to recommend. It's the book Fooled by Rand, the book Stumbling on Happiness. And it's written by Daniel Gilbert from Harvard. He did a great TED talk that I'll summarize in like less than a minute. And it's every thought we have almost is fundamentally designed to answer the question, what do I need to do to be happy in the future? And the future may be a moment from now or a minute from now or a year from now or the end of our life. The problem is we're really bad at answering that question. We're just statistically horrible at it. Think of your own life. Think of the number of things that you've done that made you happy that you never predicted in a million years. Think of the number of things that you thought were going to make you happy that once you got them, didn't really pan out, did not give you what you wanted. And boy, there's nothing worse than complaining about getting what you wanted and not being happy. No one wants to hear that. So we're bad at figuring out what will actually make us happy. We're bad at figuring out what things will make us really sad, actually. People think, I'm taking more than a minute, so I want to
make a
little divergence. In his book, he talks about how you ask people to predict how happy they would be on a scale of whatever, like 2 years out from having a child die. Ooh. And people imagine what they answer is, you know, oh, it'd be horrible. It would be whatever the number is. And then you talk to people who've had that happen. And it's not great, of course, but they're basically back to their average level of happiness with moments where they feel really sad because they had a child die. But it didn't affect them the way they thought. You ask people what it would be like if they were in prison or if they had locked-in syndrome and couldn't move their body. And what we imagine about our unhappiness is equally wrong about our happiness. So we're always trying to figure out what's going to make us happy and keep us from being unhappy, but we're horribly wrong at figuring out either of those. We're even worse at remembering how wrong we are about it. So we keep pursuing it over and over and over. And we think we're special. If we met 100 people or 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people who all had the things that we wanted and didn't have the things that we didn't want, and we found out that they're no more or less happy than we are on average, we would still go, yeah, but you know, if I got that. So look, yesterday and the day before, a couple people won large amounts of money in Mega Millions and Powerball. I guarantee most people think that if they won that money, they'd be happier.
And they do. I've talked to several of them this week,
yeah.
which is crazy to think about, right?
Guarantee that when you talk to people who won that kind of money, many of them are not only not happier, they're less happy. So again, we're horrible at it. And we think, but that's them. If I got $1.6 billion, it would be completely different because none of my friends would be begging for money. Nobody would be trying to ask for my bank account number. Nobody, you know, it's, again, we're really, really bad at it. But again, backing up to the thing to go rich, here's the survivorship bias. When that book came out, there was just this whole movement about trying to come up with ideas about how to become successful, how to master the Industrial Revolution, basically, and, you know, how to be one of these new great titans of business. There were a lot of those books. How many of them survived? How many of them do we know about?
Very few.
Think and Grow Rich. And because it survived, we think, well, it must be true because it survived. But no, it just survived for many, many other reasons, having nothing to do with the veracity of the concepts in the book.
All right, interesting. So then my follow-up question to all of that would be kind of two parts. Would be, is there any sort of way you can kind of try and figure out a way to become successful in your own life? Is there any sort of rhyme and reason, or is everything just chaos?
Well, that's a false dichotomy. So it's not that there's either methods or it's chaos. But that's another thing human beings do. It's like, well, if there's not a method, then it must be a slippery slope to anarchy and ridiculousness. And you know, why aren't gerbils sleeping with hamsters and whatever else that we're going to come up with? So I can't answer that question because it poses a false set of opposites. But I will answer the question this way. I have a master's degree in film, and something I never imagined in a million years that I would have. And one of my teachers was a guy named Milos Forman, a well-known and now late director, directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Valmont, and just amazing guy, really, really brilliant, talented guy. And somebody said to him, so how do you make a good movie? And he says, well, 90% of making a movie is casting, and the other 10% is casting. And for me, I like to think that it's a similar thing with business. 90% of it is luck, and the other 10% is luck. Oh, and then there's a whole separate 100% that's working your ass off and doing the things that you're good at and finding people to do the things that you're not good at and things like that. I mean, there's the basic business practices are fundamental. You want to have a product that people want for some reason. You want to make it so, make them aware that they can get it. And you want to then, I mean, that's really it. And everything after that is tweaking it and playing with it and crossing your fingers. And, well, ignore the cross your fingers. That's back in the luck part. Fundamentals of business are relatively straightforward. Manage your risk. Be careful of overextending. Pay attention to your competition. Be aware of macro forces in the economy. Be aware of micro. I mean, right now we're on the verge where it may be that the United States government imposes an extra 20% tariff on all goods made in China. We're having to prepare for that because that could affect us in a massive way. For people who aren't paying attention to that, it'll put them out of business, or could, more likely that it would than wouldn't if they're not prepared. So, you know, that's being aware of that all the time. I'm very, very, very lucky that somehow I met the woman who became my wife. And we have, skill sets that match each other. What's the word I'm looking for?
Compatibility.
Thank you. But I was looking for another one about sort of how they match. Regardless, my skill sets are marketing, product. Hers are operations and finance. We never talked about going into business together. We had never planned on going into business together. We were not business people when we met each other, or we weren't doing anything specifically. Neither of us have ever done anything like what we're currently doing, and we're just a really good team. And so I'm incredibly lucky. If it weren't for her, this wouldn't have happened, this whole business that we have. But what we do on a daily basis is we make good products, we treat people well, we pay attention to operations, we mitigate risk, or manage it to the extent that we can. We're trying to make sure that we have enough cash to pay the bills. We're attentive to, we pay attention to our numbers. We understand cash flow. We understand balance sheets. So those are all the simple things. But you can do all of that right. I mean, the line that I sometimes say is, you could do everything right to plan your business, but if your business was trying to open a Middle Eastern tourist agency on September 12th, you're screwed. If, on the other hand, you happen to be opening that duct tape and plastic sheeting business, you couldn't beat the money away. So you can do everything right. That doesn't guarantee that it's going to work. You can do everything wrong. That doesn't guarantee it's going to fail. So the best you can do is the best you can do. And then cross your fingers that, you know, that everything lines up. If here's a fun question you might want to do with people if they're seemingly successful. Ask them if they had any times where things failed, like if they went bankrupt or if things went bad. And ask them this question. I've done this with hundreds of people. It's really fun. Ask them, if you had to teach a college-level course on how to fail the way that you did, what would you teach?
Oh, my goodness.
It's really fun.
I love that question.
Thank you. And you're going to get a much more animated, interesting, useful answer than the answer to what made you successful. Because when you ask people what made them successful, they're going to talk about all manner of things that they think that they say they had control over that they probably didn't. When you talk about how they failed, they're going to tell you the things that they screwed up on. That many of them you can pay attention to. You can be aware of many of them. Not all of them, but again, you have more control over risk than you do over reward. So that's a fun one.
Okay, so then let's pose that question to you.
I knew
you were going to. you set yourself up for that one. Come on.
I didn't mean to, but I totally did.
So if you were going to teach a university class about failure, right, mm-hmm. and your failure, what would you be teaching about then?
One of my biggest psychological tendencies that leads to problems, and by the way, I have the idea that all businesses rise to the level of the neuroses of their founder or whoever's running it. So one of mine is that I'm a little hyper-optimistic, and I've always been an individual sport guy. I was a diver. I was then an All-American gymnast. I'm a sprinter. I don't do team sports. It's not my thing. And so I similarly have the idea that the best man wins. So the best product should just win. End of story. I had a previous company. It's actually, the company still exists. I invented what became the industry standard word processing software for film and television writers. It never in a million years crossed my mind to contact at that time, the only reseller of software like mine and say to them or ask them, what do we need to do so that the only software you sell is mine? Never occurred to me. It did occur to one of my competitors. And they ended up working out a deal where that store sold that product to the exclusion of mine because it was a better deal. So the best product didn't win. To this day, ours is still better from 25 years ago. So that's one. Another thing is that I don't want to do this. So with that company, when we started having financial problems, rather than just cutting my losses and ending it, I listened to the customers that we had who were saying, don't let this go away because it's the best product out there. And, we hate the other ones and we really, really want it. And I lost a couple $100,000 trying to redevelop the product and build it differently. And during that time, when the smart move would have been just to cut bait, and didn't do that. Now, here's the thing, back to my hindsight bias story, I may be wrong with what I'm saying. In other words, we're redeveloping the software. I finally, after literally 20 years, found someone who can code the software. Because what we invented was very complicated. And deceptively so. It looks really simple on the outside, very complicated to make it happen. And so I met a lot of programmers who thought they could fix it, but they couldn't. But if, in fact, we get it done and relaunch it, I may take over the industry again and put those other guys out of business. And then everyone's going to talk about what a success I was. And then I'm going to say, yeah, but I had 20 years where it was just crap. So is that the strategy? That what you need to do is just hold on for dear life and cross your fingers and suck up the debt and have credit card balances that you're shuffling. And, it's a horrible story. So people will say, well, it's about tenacity and perseverance. And I'm going to go, no, it's about stupidity and hyper-optimism and a whole bunch of things that are completely wrong that you don't want to emulate at all. So that's my second one, is that I how do I want to put it? If I have a belief that I'm right, and that's what I have about this product, because it is, it's demonstrably better than anything else that's been developed in the 25 years since I came up with it, or 30 years since I came up with it, then I will hold on to that belief sometimes longer than is appropriate. And so far, it's cost me a bunch of money. Do I care in the long run? Again, back to the happiness thing. Okay, let's say I lose $500,000. Whatever. I mean, that's just, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not going to use that to get all miserable. I'm going to cry. So shit happens. So what? It's not going to change how my, not going to change anything really. But, so that's another one that I do. I'm trying to think if there's another one. The programming, I tend to, I'm back to optimism. I'm also very trusting of people and are willing to give people additional tries when they, I really should, again, cut bait. And I don't tend to, I work on the assumption that people are going to do their job and do it correctly. And that's not true very often. And I don't like managing people. I just like working on the assumption that they'll just do the right thing. It doesn't happen very often. So that's gotten me into trouble as well. And again, oh well. And there's another one that was related to that. Not liking managing people. Well, here, I'll give you the simplest one. One of my best friends calls me a few years ago out of the blue. And he goes, you know what your biggest problem is? That's not how the conversation started. And I said, ooh, this is going to be interesting. He says, you will tell people when they're being factually inaccurate or logically inconsistent or simply wrong because you think the way they're going to respond is by going, oh, and then do something different because you find things like that interesting and it makes you do things different. They don't go, oh, they go, oh, you're an asshole. And I said, oh my God, I've literally never put that together before like that. And you're totally right. And he said, see, you just did it. So, I can't stop myself from it. I've tried. It doesn't work well. My head wants to explode when I hear someone saying something like, I don't know, the earth is flat or if I read Thinking Very Rich, it's going to make me successful or whatever it is. I find it almost impossible to just walk away. I find it very impossible to stay in the conversation without saying something that will make them not necessarily like me.
Yeah. Well, and this is different for me because I love listening to people with views that aren't necessarily the same as mine because then it forces you. What?
It's very unusual. You should know that. You?
Yeah, definitely. And I like that for me because it forces me to reevaluate my own position, right?
Well, so here's an interesting thing about that. So let's a lot of what we're talking about, if we really dive in, it's really evolutionary psychology. So thinking and changing your mind is from an energy standpoint, it's not evolutionarily advantageous. It takes your brain extra energy to do that. There's no good reason to do that. Back when we were figuring out how to make decisions about things, our brains figured out, oh, you make a decision and you lock onto it because that's the most energetically efficient thing you could do. And it'll weed out the idiots from the smart people, but not necessarily in the way that we think. You know, it could be that the dumb people survive because it's just a better strategy that they've come up with, even though it's not optimal. And then suddenly we think that, do you know the movie Idiocracy?
I have heard of it. I haven't actually watched it though. I definitely have that on my to watch list though.
Oh my God. I mean, the basic premise is that essentially idiots are the ones who procreate and take over the world. They win evolutionarily, and it's prescient. It seems like a documentary from the future when you see it. It's amazing. But this is what we do. We're wired to latch onto a belief and stick to it no matter what, because that's the easier thing to do. And it's why when we latch onto a belief and someone comes at us with conflicting information, rather than doing what you do, considering it and looking for the possible truth in it, what we tend to do is latch onto our belief even harder. We'll use the evidence that was just presented against our belief as a way of reinforcing our belief. It's easier to do that than to rethink a tightly held position. And so, and it's why people will hold on to tightly held positions that are patently wrong to their death. Or at least to fighting as if they're going to be killed, which is very similar. It's an amazing glitch in the hardware.
Definitely. Do you, just because I'm curious, do you think there is a way to notice that in ourselves and then to overcome it?
I would say not 100%, but yes. So the more you understand how these things work and the more you can look and identify times in your life that you've done them, the more you become aware of what it feels like when you're doing them. And when you become aware of it, you can, it does give you a little freedom to try something different. If you didn't realize that the door that you walk through every day was lower than your head height, and you couldn't figure out why you were getting headaches, and then somebody one day says to you, because the door is lower than your head, so you keep banging your head every time you walk out the door, it might, if you get, the next time you hit your head on the door, you're going to go, oh, that's the door that he was talking about. And the next time you're going to like hit the door, but not as hard because you're going to stop. And then eventually you might stop. But every now and then you have to rush out the door and you hit your head.
Okay. I love that example, because even when you do have realizations of things you do just completely wrong, right? It does seem that we, as a human species, we typically revert back in times of peril, basically, or absolutely. Rushingness.
Absolutely. Well, basically, your frontal cortex goes offline. So, literally, the line that I have is you can't be smart when you're stupid. So, in the psychological world, there's a whole idea, especially in relationships, people have this notion that there's some technique that you can learn where, A, you will never have a fight with your partner or your spouse, and that if you do, you can instantly snap out of it. And neither of those things are true. The best you can do is shorten the amount of time that it takes while you're in that kind of conflict. But when you're in dumb mode, you literally don't have that kind of mental flexibility to say something smart or compassionate or empathetic, or to realize how you're the cause of it, or any of those things that could stop it in a split second. But when you calm down enough, then that's when those things become available. There's a guy named, I forgot Gottman's first name, doesn't matter. He does research in the University of Washington on relationships. And one of his recommended techniques is that if you're in a conflict with your partner, check your heart rate. And if it's over 90, you take a timeout. Like once your heart rate's over 90, you're stupid. Get out. Just you're not going to be useful to anybody at that point. And I've never actually done that. We haven't been in that situation in quite a while, my wife and I. But I think that's a really good one. Is just use something that's unequivocal and not personal to as a cue to not get stupid.
Okay, definitely. And actually, I love this little segue here, because I mean, conflict management is a huge part of just daily living, but especially if you have a business, if you're looking to become an entrepreneur, if you're in a relationship or hope to be in a relationship one day, there's going to be conflict. So how would you go about, overcoming the conflict that is inevitably going to come up?
Well, I'll tell you, there's two situations where I have never figured it out, and I have a fantasy that maybe someday I will, but I also don't engage in that fantasy too often. One is driving behind idiots. Okay. So there's basically three roads between my office and my house, and basically it's mostly just one road. And the speed limit is 55, and most people drive 45.
Oh, man.
I use the merging lanes illegally to pass those people. otherwise, I just want to kill them. And so luckily, I got a car that accelerates really well. I can get around them. They get mad at me. Sometimes they tailgate me after that, which I think is really funny. So, but, that makes me crazy. And then stupid tech support people. There's a theme that you may have been able to figure out. Idiots in cars, stupid tech support people. That's my fundamental way of breaking out down the world, I guess, between smart people and stupid people. But so look, yesterday's an example. I'm talking to someone at Google. We had just done some things with our G Suite. They weren't working correctly, and I called for tech support. And the guy, rather than saying, oh, here's how you need to do it, said, well, you can't do it, which wasn't true. I just had to do some things before I could do the thing I wanted to do. But he never said that. He kept saying, well, you can't do it. And I had spent $5,000 to get to the point of doing this thing that I wanted to do. And so, and I was just really frustrated. And I was just like, oh, this is just, I'm so fucking mad about this. And using other language that was similar. And he said, can you speak to me in a more professional manner? And I said, well, look, man, first of all, I wasn't speaking to you like that. I was just expressing my frustration about how you guys may have misled me, and I've spent a whole lot of money. And if you can't handle syllables in a particular order, can you put me on the phone with someone who's not just a snowflake?
Oh, my goodness. Love it.
It was, I mean, look, I don't handle those things very well. I can get really obnoxious. There's no doubt about it. Sometimes I can catch myself and I can pull back. At the end of it, I apologize. He chilled out. I mean, he actually did. I said, well, I can get a manager. It's going to take an hour. I said, I don't have an hour. Can you just find a way to deal with the fact that this is the way that I talk sometimes? He goes, well, I prefer you not. I said, well, I don't know why we need to pander to the lowest common denominator. And he backed off. And then we had a great time for the next, hour that it took to solve everything. And we parted on fine ways. But yeah, I've been known to really upset some customer service people who are like reading from a script rather than answering my question. So now that said, yes, I can give you a suggestion. The best one I can think of, it's a two-parter. Part number one, you are never upset because of what somebody else did. Ever. Okay. At best, you're upset because you had an expectation of what they should or shouldn't do that they didn't meet. That's all on you. Even if they've just screwed you, the only reason you're upset is because you thought they shouldn't have, or that you think that it's going to mean something in the future about this happiness or lack thereof that it probably doesn't mean. So it's not about them, ever. The second one that's related to that is when you have that particular judgment, you shouldn't have screwed me, flip it around and ask yourself, when have I screwed other people? And if you can't find an example, you ain't looking hard enough. Really. Might not have been the same kind of situation. You might have to get a little metaphoric, but it's not hard to find out that every judgment we have ever had about another human being it's not hard to find that every judgment we've ever had about another human is something that we're as guilty of, or maybe even more guilty. We're just occasionally guilty of. Suffice it to say, we do it too. And there's two interesting things that happen as a result of contemplating that. One is, you can get over it. It's not, they didn't mean to do it. Even if they did mean to do it, that's just the way they're built. Why'd you get involved with someone who is a clear pathological liar? That's you. That's on you, man. And if they totally fooled you and they're pathological liars, okay, well, what does that mean for the future? Nothing. I mean, maybe you'll get a little smarter in the future and you'll identify some ways of, figuring this out in advance. Maybe not. I don't know. But more importantly, you're not upset for the reason you think you are. It's not because of them. It's because reality isn't matching your idea of how reality should be. And when you get unstupid and get smart again, you might notice that and, it'll chill you out a little bit. It might come back. It's not going to go away immediately, but it can become less and less affecting. Early on in my relationship with Lena, when it was one of those holiday or gift-giving holidays, including birthdays, mm-hmm. I'm notoriously hard to shop for because I don't really want anything other than, the $6,000 supercharger for my Subaru BRZ, in case anybody wants to send me the money.
We'll provide everybody with his address, so if you want to send that to him, you can do that.
And then I'll give you a ride in the car. It's an awesome car. So I would say to my wife, instead of giving me a gift, just write down everything that you don't like or are mad at me about and just read it to me. Stephen, I don't like this. I wish you were this. I don't like it when you that. You should this. You shouldn't that. And I just wanted to hear them all. And there wasn't anything she ever said that I either couldn't literally agree with or metaphorically agree with. And I just appreciated hearing it. And inevitably, by meeting it with just the truth, like, oh, you're right, I actually do that. I don't want to do that, but I find that in certain circumstances, I get really upset or stressed out, and that's what happens afterwards. And my apologies, I wish I had a way of reliably not doing that, but I haven't figured that out yet. I'm open to suggestions, and I'm really sorry that that's the way this one works for now. Maybe it'll change in the future, maybe not. If you can't handle it, I totally get that you would want to leave. I hope you don't. I mean, just responding to things that are true. And then inevitably at the end, Lena would often say things like, it's just as true for me, or what I was just saying is really not about you, or whatever. And I wasn't doing it to be manipulative and get her to respond that way. It's just when you can meet someone with a criticism with nothing other than the truth, there's nothing to fight about. The most obnoxious thing you could say about me, there's no question about it that I've had the same thought probably 1,000 times more than you have. And it's probably something that I don't like about myself, and I wish I could change, and it doesn't seem to change. that's not a problem. It's just the way it is. And I recognize that it's not optimal and I wish I could do it differently. And the only thing that that's happened to me as a result of continually engaging in this sort of contemplation is that I no longer add the extra bonus of, beating myself up because this is the way it is. So if you called me obnoxious or, arrogant or whatever, some of the things that, you know, I would occasionally hear, it's like, oh my God, I totally think that I'm better than a lot of people. And it's actually something that I strive to be sometimes. And I know that it comes out in a horrible, horrible way sometimes. And it's condescending or rude or obnoxious or curt. And I don't like that because, frankly, the reason that I wanted to be better than other people is so they wouldn't like me. So I know that it's counterproductive and I just haven't found a way to do it differently. And I'm totally open to suggestions. Right now, the best I have is admitting that it's true and apologizing for the seeming knee-jerk response that we're, you know, for how it comes out. I'm obviously not like this all the time, but in my worst moments, you know, it's undeniable. And, I'm open.
Definitely. And I think there's a ton of power in just being open to that criticism and admitting it, you know?
There absolutely is. And the only reason that we're not is because we think something bad will happen if we are, or because it's something that we don't like about ourselves, so we've been trying to hide. And there's the like meta level where, crap, not only is it true, but my attempts to hide it aren't effective either. So I'm even worse because I can't even hide it well enough. But, you know, that's just a loop. I mean, the simple thing is exactly what you said, is if we can, and again, you can't necessarily do it in real time. You might need to take a break and come back. But the simple thing is, if you can just go, yeah, I found that one. Yep. The response on the other end is, my experience is, it's never what you expect. Ever.
Definitely. And what you fear. Say that again?
I said, or what you fear.
Gotcha. Yeah. And it's one of those things where we try to hide these things that are wrong with us, but then we find out that everyone already knows. Right.
Well, not only does everyone already know, but again, if we do the behavioral, the evolutionary psychology thing, they're not even wrong with us. They're a symptom of being human.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like my body. No one likes their body.
Everyone wishes they had a better body, six pack abs, were skinnier.
You know, like, I don't like this thing. But more, I don't know that this is true, but think of it this way. When we never got to the point where we could look at a glass of water and know if there was E. coli in it. So instead of having the ability to see bacteria, we're hypersensitive to what our body is doing. And since now we don't have to really be hypersensitive to what our body is doing, because food is usually clean and water is usually clean, we're just hypersensitive in general. Now,
interesting.
Again, maybe that's not the evolutionary track, but it's certainly not too far off.
Yeah, I could see that because in general, I feel like when there is a system in place that has a purpose and it's not getting that purpose used, it figures out another way to be useful.
Totally. Totally. Someone asked Larry David, the co-creator of Seinfeld and creator of Curb Your Enthusiasm, they said, so do you not worry about money now that you've gotten so much money from doing all these things? And he said, the part of my brain that used to worry about money when I was going to the grocery store at 2 a.m, because the only thing I could afford was a can of soup and I had to pay with change, that part of my brain doesn't worry about money anymore. But it's got a lot of other stuff to do.
Oh my goodness, I love it. I love it. So now, one of the things that I'm extremely passionate about and want to understand better of just in general how people can become better at this is the concept of leadership. So I'd love to hear what your concept of leadership is, maybe where you've had failures, because you do like to talk about the failures, and then maybe some suggestions that may or may not be applicable based on, you know, your philosophy that there's never a perfect system.
Yeah. So I don't know one leader who ever took a course on leadership. So that's thing number one. Thing number two, there's different kinds of leaders and there's different kind of leadership. And I called a friend of mine one day. I said, I don't feel like a CEO. I don't think I have CEO skills. Pardon me, I don't know why I got the hiccups. He said, I don't think I have CEO skills. He goes, oh, you just don't understand what a CEO is. I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, there's different kinds. There's financial kinds. They really understand just the math of how business works. There's management kinds. They understand how to put together teams and work with teams. There's product and marketing kinds. That's what you are. I said, oh, and it's true. That's what my skill set is mostly about. And as a product marketing CEO, quote, leader, what I'm good at is inspiring people to get on board my vision and want to be part of that. Why or how? I don't know. That's just the way this one's built. But I'm not good at the other ones. One of my lines is I say, I don't really care about people. And what I mean by that is that I, like I said before, I just want them to and expect that they'll just do their job and that they don't need nurturing or they don't need handholding or they don't need me to be constantly telling them that I think they're wonderful. I don't need them, don't need to give them gold stars. I think that they'll do the same thing I do, which is do the work for the work's sake. But that's actually not the case. So I'm not good at that. I'm also not good at putting on a good face when something's going wrong. If we've had a production problem, man, I am not a happy camper. My typical strategy, not strategy, my typical pattern is I kind of rant and rave and I'm upset for a day or some amount of time. And then I just get down to how do we fix it? And I don't even, and mostly I just get down to how do we fix it? And I don't even want to hear anything else. Like if someone says, well, we're having this problem because of, I don't need the because. I just need to know what the problem is. Now let's solve it. I don't care about the because. And so I have written on my whiteboard just to my left, energetic field modulator. So this is a friend of mine who's a managerial CEO.
Okay.
And this is your job is to be an energetic field modulator. You got to keep people like upbeat, inspired and things like that. When even if things are going bad, and we've never had things that were going particularly bad, but I'm not really good at that because I kind of wear my thoughts on my sleeve. And, can I train myself to do that better? Maybe. I don't know. Do I have the urge to do it? Sometimes. Do I think that I can? I don't think I have enough time. I don't think I've got enough on my plate that I'm not confident that I could spend the mental energy to do that in a way that wouldn't be sucking mental energy away from things that are helping make this business grow. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm open to that possibility as well. But suffice it to say, the biggest thing I can think of on the leadership thing is when you're in it, whatever you're doing, that the more you can be attentive to the feedback and again, at least willing to just own the problem, the better. Maybe you'll find there's something that you can do better technically. Let people know when you're about to send an email that's going to get $100,000 for the business instead of surprising them. or let them know if you're going to do something that's affecting them and that's distracting them from something they're going to do in a way that they can tolerate it better instead of expecting everyone to work on my kind of like need to know basis method. Again, everything rises to the level of neuroses of the guy in charge or woman in charge. Are you able to change those things? Some yes, some no. And it may be that the best thing you can do as a quote leader is find someone else to run the thing at a certain point. So I don't really concern myself too much with the concept. I'm aware of it. I don't, I kind of come back to the same sort of hindsight bias, survivorship bias thing. And like what I said at the beginning of your question, I don't know one leader who took a course on leadership. And so if it were that simple, everybody would do it. And human beings, look, you could be the best leader in the world, but if half your staff comes down with Ebola, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
If someone who's important to your company has a spouse that has to leave the country, just happened to us, it doesn't matter how good of a leader you are. There's things that you can do to encourage people. Look, here's a fun story. We had an employee who I came to one day and said, you're really, really smart and you're not being utilized. What do you want to do? Now that you've been here for a while, what would be the ultimate job that you would want to have in this company? And she laid it out. I went, let's do it. Awesome. I'm on board. Here's some tools that I know of that could be helpful for you just to see if, maybe you know these things, maybe you don't, but it could be really helpful. 2 days later, she quit. But in her exit interview, she said, I didn't feel like there's anywhere for me to grow in this company. It's like, I'm sorry, what? I just let you create your own job. I gave you everything you would need to do it successfully. It's like, what are you going to do? So I don't care how good of a leader you are when you're dealing with someone where that's their psychology that is just going to interfere with whatever plans you have. So, so I guess the shortest answer to your question is I don't even know what that word means, really, given that no one is a perfect leader. And look, a bunch of our best leaders ever, they've gotten shot in the head.
Yeah. It's true.
So it's, yeah, I spend most of my time, and it's, look, again, it's why I'm really thrilled to be married to my wife. She's the one who pays more attention to humans and their psychology than I do. And good. Most people in my company don't even know what I do. Really? Because I'm the internet marketing guy, and the product, whatever person. I mean, they certainly have no concept for how I do what I do. I don't think they even know the what I do, let alone how. That's cool.
Definitely. And what I love about this is that so many people, when they think of leadership, think of like an ultimate leader, but I don't personally believe in that concept. I believe that like, if there are different capacities to be a leader. And I think that the best companies, best organizations have different types of leaders. And I loved how you emphasized that with your whole story, right? You're one type of leader. You yeah. have different strengths, different weaknesses. And then you have someone else who has different types of strengths and different weaknesses. And you guys make up for each other.
Yeah. If we think about some business leaders of recent times, it's very interesting. So everyone loves to use Steve Jobs as an example. And I get a kick out of the movies and books that have come out since. Yeah. He did this part really well, but he was really a dick. And he was really good at certain things and other things not really good at. And we like to dismiss those, or we like to discount them, or say that it's part of the way it is. You know, when you're that kind of person, that's just the way you are. Maybe, I don't know. But again, there's this whole thing where we want to try and put things in neat little boxes, and things are not in neat little boxes, especially people who are unusual. And anyone who's an entrepreneur or CEO of some rapidly growing company or a big company, they're unusual. Anyone who wants to be president, and I'm not talking about our current president, anyone who wants to be president is nuts, just by definition. And even our favorite presidents, crazy people in a certain way, because who would want that job? It is just flat out crazy. So, you know, the more kind of out there you are in any given way, the harder it is going to be to put you in a box. And yet that's exactly what we all want to do, especially if we can put it in a box and wrap it up and hand it to someone and say, if you just do this, you can have what they had. Not the case.
Yeah. And I definitely 100% agree with that. And like, just like from my personal philosophies, I think there's generalities. And kind of like you were saying earlier, there's general business concepts that you have to have a successful business, but that doesn't guarantee anything.
Right.
Now, if you have the better business concepts, you're more likely to have a successful business. But if something comes out of the blue that you didn't plan, it could all go to hell in a handbasket, right?
Yeah. I don't know if anyone's actually done the research on or have been able to identify whether knowing certain things, for example, does correlate to more likelihood of certain kinds of, I don't even want to use the word success, certain metrics that you might achieve.
Yeah. But
maybe. I lean in the direction that it's, I don't know. It would be really interesting. I think it's probably true that certain things help to a certain extent, but is there a guarantee from anything to anything? Nah.
Definitely. I love that. Now, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think I should be asking you?
That was fun to do. I can't think of anything. I'm more curious. Let me ask you a question. I've been asking you in a way that I really like. Oh, you have to wrap this up soon, apparently. So what's the most interesting thing to you lately that is either perplexing or is just making you want to dive really deep into it to find out what's underneath?
The big thing that I've been reading about lately is this concept of flow, right? This you know, this theoretical chemistry that works in the brain that could theoretically be hacked into to unlock a higher level of potential than you would normally have by mastery from the traditional sense where you practice 10,000 hours and you become a master.
Okay, I'm about to mess you up, right?
Yeah, go for it. I love that. Go for it.
So the 10,000 hour thing is complete bullshit. Mm-hmm. And I knew this from the moment I heard it because I was a former competitive gymnast and I'm a competitive sprinter. There's no gymnast or sprinter in the world who's ever put in 10,000 hours. It's physically not possible. I knew that right away. And there have been a number of people who have debunked that whole idea that it's just a matter of putting in the time, including the guy who came up with the whole 10,000 hour idea. The guy who came up with that was completely misrepresented by Malcolm Gladwell and by whatever his name was, who wrote the first book about it, the Gladwell Rift on. He's routinely said, yeah, misrepresented what I said entirely. So the idea that it's just, and first of all, the psychology of someone who is inspired to put in 10,000 hours is a totally different psychology than anyone else, and you can't recreate that. That one is the enigmatic thing. The flow thing, there's a bunch of evidence that predominantly from athletes, there's no evidence that when somebody was in the flow state, they actually performed any better than when they weren't. So it's, and you're talking to someone who's lived through it many, many times. And the question of whether that translates into business, for example, that's an interesting one to me. Business people love the idea of sports metaphors being true for business as well. It's not my experience. Part of the whole idea with flow is that you're putting yourself in a very difficult situation where what's really happening is part of your brain goes offline. So it's not that you have a heightened something. It's literally that part of your brain shuts down. And there's a woman named Joy Hirsch who did some of the first research putting people's heads in an fMRI machine to see how it works. And there's all these inhibitory feedback loops in your brain. And part of what seems to be happening during the flow state is that some of those get shut down. And you have the feeling that you know what's happening in advance because processing information takes time, and when you turn off some of the loops that process information, the feeling is that they're happening more in real time. It's no more or less. It seems like you see things better and you have better paths, and because you kind of do. But no one's ever been able to. No one ever talks about like changing things during that. It's like think about déjà vu. Every time you have a déjà vu experience, you can't change it. You just notice that wow, it feels like I've been here before. And then at some point it stops, but never in the middle of it do you go, oh, it feels like I've been here before. I'm going to do something different this time. You just sort of observe that it happened and then it's over. And I think that quote deja vu thing is a very similar phenomenon. And it's just when certain inhibitory feedback loops in the processing of information shut down for some reason. Can you recreate that? Can you set up the conditions to recreate that? You can, to a certain extent, in very, very specialized situations. Can you do that in business? I don't know. Can you do that? If what you do is a specific thing over and over and over, like negotiating, maybe you can. Maybe there's times where you get in that groove and you can look. There's times where I used to do, let's say, counseling, consulting for people. And there's times where I could just feel and almost literally see the psychological path that they were going on. And I could just kind of move down that path and get to where the beginning of it was. And help them tweak something, and a whole bunch of things change. Could I do that every time? No. Could I do it reliably because I was an expert in that thing? Yeah. But does that apply to other parts of my life? Definitely not. So now here's the thing with flow. The most important thing with flow is being able to pronounce the name of the last name of the guy who wrote the book.
Oh my goodness.
You do it.
No, yeah. I can't. No.
Just a Csikszentmihalyi. Doable. But you got to learn that one. Csikszentmihalyi. So again, this is one of those things like where you're going, and this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, is I would argue, and I'm maybe wrong, and pardon me if I'm getting personal, that part of the interest in doing that is related to the thing of let me find and see if there's a system that will get me reliably to what I want. Which is that, again, that fundamental human thinking process that is flawed. So the basic idea underneath that interest may be a little misguided. Or it may be just totally fascinating and you're just really curious, just sort of at, let's say, an academic level. And it may be that you find an application for it that no one else had found before. I don't know. But it's one of those things that, in my mind, when I hear people talk about that, it's usually because they're trying to create some better experience thinking that it will lead to a better outcome. And I guess, and I'm not trying to make myself any more or less of anything when I say this, I have just stopped caring. You know, I just, like, it's just not my concern. One of the things I like to say is, what do I care what I think about me? It's just a thought. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Who gives a shit? But I'm not going to worry. I'm not going to bother myself by trying to change these thoughts that arise and pass away in my mind that I have no control over, because that just seems like a Herculean or Sisyphean effort that will, you know, never give me the results that I really want. It's much easier just not to care. And I'm not apathetic. I just don't. I mean, you know, like if you woke up tomorrow and you looked in the mirror, or if you woke up tomorrow and before you looked in the mirror, you had the thought, I'm a tall black woman. And then, you know, it wouldn't do anything to you. You would think, oh, that's goofy. And then you look in the mirror just to check. But, you know, it wouldn't cause you any angst. Now, if you are a tall black woman listening to this, then ignore that entirely. Then it's completely consistent with who you are. But if you're not a tall black woman, and that thought popped in your head, it would just seem kind of silly. Well, why doesn't the thought, I'm not successful enough, why doesn't that seem as silly? Why doesn't the thought, people don't like me, why doesn't that seem as silly? Why doesn't the thought, I need to be thinner, why doesn't that seem as silly? They're all just as silly if they have anything to do with the thought following, which would be, because if I were, then I'd be happy. Those thoughts are absurd. They should make us just, like, chuckle. Every day, I'll tell you, here's another thing I'll tell you about me. Every day, maybe not every day, but 99.9% of the days, I wake up, and as I'm rolling out of bed, I pinch my skin by my abdomen to see if I lost weight and got thinner. It's a habit, as if I somehow, overnight, slept enough to end up with a six-pack. Why do I do this? It's absurd. But I don't care anymore, because that's just one of the things that this one does. And it's just silly. And you know, what are you going to do? And do I think that I would be happier if I was at 10% body fat instead of 16% body fat? No, not really. I think I'd be going, shit, why can't I should get to 9. I should really get to 9. And I know that's how my brain works. That's how I think. That there's a certain dissatisfaction with this thing, regardless of the fact that other people have whatever responses they have to it. And that's just the way it is. So I don't add the extra whatever of getting all riled up about the fact that I check my body so differently.
Oh, well, at least you know you're not alone, that most people have the exact same thing, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm aware of that too. There are people who are way less thin than I am, who you know, think the fact that I do that is absurd. But it's like, this is what we do. We're absurd.
Yeah. We are absurd. That's what I love about people, right? We all are absurd in some sort of way, right?
Oh my God, that is a fact. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. So,
anyway.
So I'm just curious, because you brought up you did like consulting and counseling. Is that right?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm just because I'm purely curious, what is your path from where more or less you started to today?
If I had to sum it up, the through line for all of it is I just like to figure out how things work. And for whatever reason, from the time I was very, very young, psychology was really interesting to me. And I was a cognitive psych major in college. I did research on cognitive aspects of motor skill acquisition and weird things like, do we have an innate sense of rhythm or not? And do some people have a better one than others? The answer is yes, we do, and no, we don't. Or no, we aren't. When I was young, I thought there was a, you know, handful of things that were wrong with me that either psychology or meditation would fix. I eventually got over that thought. But during the time when I believed things like that, I met people who were teaching various forms of psychological whatever, and I became very good at those and was teaching those and working with human beings. And then somehow I got back into sprinting after a 30-year break, I'm like, and it's interesting, you know, my if you look at my office, it's a total mess. Piles of things everywhere and whatnot. I'm not an organized person, but the things that I like doing physically are all very organized. I like doing things that are very precise. Sprinting, target shooting, gymnastics, Zen archery. These are all things that you can't get perfect, but that's the goal. And there is better than less better, but you're never going to, like at the end of a track meet, someone will say, "How'd you do?" And I say, with or without the excuse. Because inevitably, you know, you'll say, "Well, you know, I did okay, but I kind of pulled up at the 80 meter mark, or I tripped coming out of the blocks, or I looked up and I didn't have my drive phase long enough." And there's always something. You can never get it perfect. Usain Bolt, when he set the world record, stood up 10 meters before the end of the race. You know, it's like, what are you going to do? So after I got back into sprinting, a thing that I found to get rid of my injuries was running barefoot. And then I just started exploring the reality behind footwear and running biomechanics and health and fitness, and discovered that natural movement is the appropriate way to live. There's no other part of your body where a doctor would suggest you wrap it up and never use it again other than your feet. Why don't we think that's stupid? And the reason we don't think it's stupid is we've had shoe companies telling us that makes sense for 50 years until we all went, yeah, okay, whatever. I'll go with that. We've got people who we think of as smart telling us that that's true. And we go, okay, I believe you. They're all wrong. And then that accidentally led me to starting a footwear brand where we now have casual and performance shoes and sandals that let people's feet move naturally, so you can have the fun and benefits of just like being barefoot, but with some protection for whatever you're doing. And then there's a whole bunch of other strands to that piece of rope that also led here. This is for both Lena and I. This is really kind of the culmination of everything we've ever done in our life in many ways, and it just fell in our lap through all these crazy lucky circumstances.
That's awesome. I love it. And I think it's really interesting because I think the people who have the best businesses, who come up with the best ideas in the world, find something that they've been passionate about for a long time and just try and innovate something that other people aren't thinking of or didn't consider.
It really helps to be really, really interested in what you're doing. Yeah. I don't know if it really helps or not. I like it. And as Lena loves to say, there's no reason to start another shoe company unless your shoes change people's lives. And that's what we've done. And I like saying that. I don't think there's a good reason to run a company unless it changes people's lives. I'm not suggesting that's the only way to do it. I know a lot of people who've done it for other reasons, who've done very well in different ways. But for me, that's the only way that I'm interested. And I only want to do things that are interesting to me.
Gotcha. So from this point going forward, what do you kind of see as where you want to be getting to in the future?
We want to change the world. I mean, really. In the same way that natural food is seen now as the obvious, better, healthy choice, we want to make natural movement the same kind of thing. And we want to be the preeminent brand in the natural movement world. And that's what we're trying to make happen. We're doing what I like to say is we're creating a movement. And we want people to experience the fun and benefits of getting your feet out of things that don't let them work naturally, that are restrictive and insulate you too much from the ground and don't let them move and make you lose your balance when you get older so you can do what my dad did, which is trip, fall down, break it up and die. And just, you know, look, if you like being barefoot, the idea that you would then put your feet in something like most shoes is ridiculous. So we want to be part of, pardon the early 70s, all footwear was more like ours, and there weren't the same kind of injuries, there weren't the same kind of problems that people currently have. We're just going back in time, not to the 70s, maybe to, you know, the literally the 70s, like year 70. When people were wearing simpler footwear and not having problems. You go to countries that haven't developed the way the West has, where they don't have this kind of footwear, and you also won't find podiatrists. So we're just trying to create this whole movement to get people to enjoy the fun and benefits of natural movement. Anyway, that's the gist of it.
That's awesome. I love that concept because I've been someone who walked around barefoot in the past, and people are like, "You're crazy. Why would you go around barefoot?" And I don't know. There's something that just feels a little bit more natural about it. It just feels like it should be like that.
Yeah, because that's the way it was for a long time. And then footwear was just developed for the situations where that wasn't appropriate. End of story. So
awesome. So if someone wants to get a hold of you or contact you, find out more about you or your company, what's the best way to go about doing that?
You can go to our website, of course, zeroshoes.com, and that's X-E-R-O shoes. On social, we're at Zero Shoes everywhere. You can be at Zero Shoes and / Zero Shoes at the places you can't. And that's where everything exists. I am my company at this point. I have a website that had something about my life on it. I literally haven't looked at it in the last 5 years, so I don't even know what it says. So the best thing is just to go to Zero Shoes or any of the social properties.
Awesome. And if you were to leave one takeaway for everyone to remember from this episode or just from you in general, what would that one takeaway you'd want them to have be?
Anything that you think is true, take a look and see. Just check. Like, look for a counterfactual. See if you can find examples where the opposite is as true, if not more true. And just keep diving deeper and deeper to see what you discover underneath our thoughts and beliefs. And where you may land might surprise you and give you what you truly wanted in a way that you never expected.
Some of the main takeaways I got from this conversation include there are multiple types of leaders, and you have to discover what type of leader you are and live into it. There's also a lot of psychological biases and other dysfunctions that humans have that we really have to look at and face if we're going to face the path to get towards achieving legendary leadership. And it's not an easy path, and it's not easily duplicatable. Is it possible? Debatably. But it's not easy, and there are definitely many exceptions to the rules, and the psychological biases that go along with all of this makes it that much more difficult. Thanks for listening to this episode. Please make sure to go to your favorite podcast player of choice and there rate the podcast. Then subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And then, if you truly want to be a leader, share this episode with someone that you know will be impacted, because the best leaders fuel not only themselves, but others as well to their heroic potential. If you want to unlock your heroic potential faster, then you will want to join the League of Legendary Leaders, an association of leaders who are dedicated to unlocking their heroic potential, unlocking the heroic potential of others, and where legendary leaders are born. We also have a goal to raise $100,000 monthly to support nonprofits that are actively undertaking causes to impact the future in areas including neurodiversity, character strength, positive psychological research, homelessness, and more. Seize the call now. Go to www.theleadership.guide and click Get Free Guidance to propel you on your journey to legendary leadership. I'm your host, Cody Dakota, and I'm honored to have spent this time with you today. My final message for you, and listen closely. It's time. Wake up your potential. Let go of your fears and anxieties. And let's discover what is possible on your journey to become a legendary leader. Emerge and become who you were meant to be.